Right, we're very much coming up to Christmas and that time of year when we celebrate the birth of Christ. Although, if you're sort of wandering around, looking at the shops, listening to the various, what they call Christmas carols, you know, a lot of the Christmas carols that are sung don't really relate too much to God. A lot of the Christmas songs are about everything else, you know, White Christmas and Santa on his sleigh and reindeer and things like that. And with all of the shops and everything, you just wonder what Christmas is all about. And it can be easy as a Christian to become a little bit distracted or frustrated at the way the world is around this time of year. And what I want to do is, as we get into this season, to kind of remind us that for us, it should be a time of reflection and a time of remembrance, a memorial annually of what Jesus, what God has done in sending Jesus into the world. It is meant to be a celebration of the coming of our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ. The clue is in the name, Christmas, Christmas. That is what it is, that is where it comes from. One thing that I found quite funny coming out from America and Donald Trump was that he wants to bring back the concept of Christmas and do away with this happy holiday type thing. So good on him for that. But I don't think it's too much of a problem in America, but except to the extent that the secularisation is progressing there as everywhere else in the West, and it becomes a problem in some areas. What is, you know, you'll have noticed a theme around the songs that we've been singing today. Well, maybe you've noticed it, maybe you haven't. But they're all big picture stuff. They're all talking about the greatness of God and what God has done for us. And that is very much, you know, what this time of year should be all about for us. I don't know if you appreciate it or not. There's a branch of science called cosmology, the study of the cosmos. And in its fullness, it is the study of the origin, evolution, and eventual fate of the universe. A very grand concept and title. And in fact, there are many theories abound as to how the cosmos came into being, how this universe that we live in came into being. Even within Christianity, there can be conflict and opposing theories that come about. I'm not here to speak too much about any one, except to basically say that certainly it is my belief, and I believe every Christian should believe, that whatever they think the mechanics of it is, God is at the heart of it. Because otherwise, it makes God a liar. Because God said, He created. And I am therefore a creationist. Now, how God created, I don't know. You can read the Bible in one part and take something from it. You can read it in another part and take slightly something else from it. You can make a lot of the way in which sections of the Bible are written. You know, a lot of people say Genesis 1, Genesis 2 is poetry. It's not meant to be taken literally, etc. And yet there are, you know, there are many Christians who say, no, it's 7 days of creation And a day is 24 hours. Even before there was a day, it must have been 24 hours. You know, so this is, you know, some people's earnest belief. Scientists have developed this concept they call the Big Bang. And they say God wasn't involved. It was all freakish chance. That there is no place for God in the universe. And, you know, in saying that, the Big Bang is one of, again, numerous even secular concepts of cosmology. Been looking at New Scientist magazine lately. There was one article in there that caught me. I'll come on to in a minute. But while I was looking at that, I tripped over this other one. The top 10 weirdest cosmology theories. I'm not going to go into the detail of them. They get a little bit kind of... But there's one called Clashing Brains. B-R-A-N-E-S, not I-N-S. Right? Could our universe be a membrane floating in higher dimensional space, repeatedly smashing into a neighbouring universe? And some people believe that. Scientists. Evolving universes. When matter is compressed to extreme densities at the centre of a black hole, it might bounce back and create a new baby universe. Superfluid space-time. Wonderful concepts, aren't they? I love this one. The Goldilocks universe. Why does the universe have properties that are just right? There's a question, isn't it? Why does it have properties that are just right to permit the emergence of life? You know, tinker with it just a little bit and all life becomes extinct instantly or becomes impossible from the outset. So that's one of the concepts, one of the beliefs. They don't know the hows and the wheres. God couldn't have been involved, but it's an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? Gravity reaches out. The power of gravity is the heart and soul and core of the universe and brought it into being, is one of the thoughts. Another one is called cosmic ghost. Sterile neutrinos. And if you remember one of the films that was out a while ago, In the Matrix. In other words, we're all actually a figment of a greater being's imagination. And we don't really truly exist at all. So there's a lot of concepts behind cosmology. And the thing about, you know, science and scientists, I love science and I love scientists. And I think science has got a place on this earth, in this life. It helps us in a lot of ways. But it does have boundaries. And one of the problems with science is when you're looking at something where you cannot see the whole picture, you end up having to project the knowledge that you do have into the knowledge that you don't have in order to develop what we call theories that answer why we are where we are. And this is why cosmology has so many of these concepts. These are all scientifically valid, although some would argue, some to a lesser extent than others perhaps, but they all have a basis of scientific validity because they take elements of measurable understanding and then project them into these theories. Of course, the secular concept does that routinely leaving God out of the picture? It becomes a very different developing theory when you bring God into the picture. And it's interesting how many times our understanding from the Bible, we actually trip over in some of these theories, although they are trying desperately to leave God out of the picture. The thing about the reason why they're theories and not facts is because they cannot be proven. We are in an unfortunate position that we can't prove the Bible concept. But science is coming closer to helping us do that. Hence this other article that I found. And this was quite recent. It was only October this year. And it's titled, you know, Why Our Freakish Galaxy Has Got Cosmologists Worried. Right? Or seriously worried. You can see the heading there. What it is, you see, is science is all based on measurement. And up until very recently, up until the past 10, 20 years, we started something 20, 30 years ago, but we're only just starting to see the fruits of it. 20, 30 years ago, we were launching deep space missions. We were launching spacecraft that would go to the edge of our galaxy and send back information. Now, they are travelling, you know, further than any man has travelled before. And they, because, you know, when you look at the horizon, you know, normally if you're standing on the seashore looking out to sea, they reckon the furthest that you can see is about 3 miles. And that was where in the olden days we used to have this flat earth philosophy. Because whenever you looked, everything appeared flat. And you would travel on and it kept, that flatness just opened up in front of you, right? And the thought was lost that the reason why the horizon actually is so close is because it's falling away beyond that to some degree. And that's part of the reason why we've got a limited view of the horizon. We can only see 3 miles. If it was truly flat, we'd be able to see on and on and on. But, you know, we believed at one time that it was flat. Then people realised through science this was related to our world and our view of the stars at the time. The thought arose, maybe we're not, you know, flat, maybe we're round. Then it moved from there to maybe the stars don't revolve around us, maybe there's mutual movement, etc. So our knowledge of where we are, our place in space-time becomes more open to us the more the measurements we're able to take. But up until recently, all of the measurements, all of the scientific evidence that we've gathered comes from our own galaxy. We've never been able before to reach out and see other galaxies. The Big Bang Theory is a projection of our understanding based on what we know about our own galaxy. And one of the fundamentals of the Big Bang, now, I'll remind you, for all of these hundreds of different theories of cosmology, the secular world believes, and even a lot of Christians believe, because bear in mind there's a big question mark over the how, and there's a lot of Christians who are at heart, you know, scientists as well, and they will go along with the prevalent scientific theory. And the prevalent scientific theory says Everything was started in the Big Bang. Now, if you can imagine, you know, if we had a Big Bang in the middle of this room, right? In other words, a massive explosion that blew Robina Memorial Hall into 1,000 pieces and spread them throughout Cardiff. As you go around picking up the bits and pieces that are spread around, they're all going to be pretty much of a muchness, aren't they? They all come from a common beginning, therefore there's common elements around them. That's the thinking that where we recognise what we recognise and then take that back. So, somewhere out there, there's other galaxies that are not unlike ours, where there's every possibility that there's life. No, there's not. That's what this is saying. The evidence that's now coming back from beyond our galaxy is actually our galaxy is unique. That we are not like our neighbouring galaxies. That we are somehow strange, peculiar, and that life cannot exist in those other galaxies. And therefore, something strange has happened in the Milky Way that somehow fits it for life. And even within the Milky Way, something strange and unique has happened in our corner of the galaxy that somehow fits us for life. Now that, I think, is quite exciting. You know, because it just throws everything up in the air again. That brings me back to the Bible. Because that's what we are interested in. Although, what I'm saying there isn't, you know, removed. It's about looking at worldview, but then relating it to the Bible. Where is my faith in the Bible? Where does it come from? And Christmas has got a lot to say about my faith and why I believe in creation in particular.
Would this be the Goldilocks galaxy then?
Oh, it could well be the Goldilocks galaxy. But not just purely by chance, as they may have you think, you know. The first half of the book of Isaiah is written reportedly around 700 BC, right? Isaiah, the first half of it, up to about chapter 39, they reckon was written around 700 BC. They reckon the second half of Isaiah must have probably been written not by Isaiah himself, but by somebody else, because that's dated and it picks up historical information which appears to be 100 years closer to our timeline. So either Isaiah lived for an exceptionally long period of time and did nothing for 100 years, or there may have been two authors in the book of Isaiah, but we have got beginning of Isaiah, end of Isaiah. Now, that fact is used by many to throw doubt on some of the prophecies that Isaiah writes about. However, what is undisputed is that those prophecies were written many hundreds of years before they came about. And it's in the book of Isaiah that we find, for example, Isaiah 7 and verse 14. Where it says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. Do you know what the word Emmanuel means?
God with us.
God with us. Absolutely right. So this child give birth to a son. A virgin will give birth to a son. That means no human father. Right? And as humans do not have the capability, as some plants do, of self-impregnating, right? That means that this is a very strange child indeed. It is a miracle child with no human father, and he's going to be called Emmanuel. And you know what they say, the clues in the name. As I said about Christmas, the clues in the name. And the clues in the name here as well. Because this is a son who is God in the flesh. God with us. And in Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7. It says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end." So this is an eternal ruler. "He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." Now, that says a lot about, you know, continuing on this theme, this child, who he's going to be, what he's going to be, how significant he is. And just to give us some more foundation, Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 to 2. It says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord." So that ties that back to the previous one, you know, where, you know, his name shall be called, you know, all of these things, Prince of Peace. And so you can see we're talking about the same person here. And strangely, well, not strangely at all for us, but, you know, the book of Isaiah actually contains 20 different prophecies directly relating to Jesus Christ. And some of it, you know, I'm going to sort of mention some of these things. But, you know, the first half, when we're saying Isaiah seems to be split into two, the early part of Isaiah talks about Jesus' birth. The latter part talks about his death. Right? And Isaiah 40, for example, verses 3 and 4, sorry, 3 to 5, actually foresees, prophesies, John the Baptist, right? In verses, chapter 50 and verse 6, it talks about Jesus Christ being, or it talks about him being spat on and struck. "I gave my back to the smiters and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting." You know, these are personalized graphical accounts that we can link into, and you see them picked up. You know, if we look at Matthew 26:67. Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands. You know, this goes on and on and on. The picture that is portrayed in Isaiah and then picked up in the New Testament Gospels, it's almost as if the writer in Isaiah was an eyewitness to what was going on. The detail is beyond refute. And everybody can acknowledge and recognize that in Jesus Christ, prophecy is fulfilled. And that prophecy was written several hundred years before Jesus was born. Who did that? How did that come about? Now, nobody. The reason why all of this cosmology is all theory is because as old as I look when I look in the mirror, I wasn't there. None of us were. We can only imagine what it was like. We don't know. Now, I don't know what you're like at prophecy, but I could try and prophesy what might happen here in this room in 5 minutes from now, and I'll probably be wrong. There'll be some aspect of it that I just won't get right, and I'm only talking 5 minutes, right? Because there's always random, up to us, apparently random things that seem to come up. You know, and we don't know why. You know, we get these little things that happen and it just changes. You know, one of the big things I teach in university is strategy and strategy development. And as I tell my students, it's a very complex subject. The tools that you use are very, very simple, but it's a complex subject because you're trying to forecast. You're trying to prophesy what the future will be like in 1, 2, 5 years' time. And then you're making plans that are going to, you know, sort of take you into that future. But those plans have got to be flexible and changeable because there's nothing more certain than you will get bits of it wrong. You hope you don't get too much of it wrong, but there's a good chance that you'll get some of it wrong. And that's simple, short-term prophecy. There's nobody in this world can do it well. If they could, we would never have market crashes, economy crashes, banks failing, companies going out of business. That would be the multi-million pound business of our day. To be able to foretell what the lottery numbers are going to be this week. What horse is coming in at 3 o'clock at Kempton Park. You know, we would all be rich beyond our wildest dreams, except that I think it would probably bankrupt the country in no time flat, looking at it from another perspective. So in one sense, it's a good job we can't. But the fact that we can't brings you back to the awesomeness of the fact that 600 years before Jesus was born, the detail that was given about him was as if it was eyewitness accounts. I mean, we're not just talking about at some point in the future something big's going to happen. We can all say that. And then when something happens, we just all say, see, I told you so. You know, but give us the detail. Prove what you're saying. And that's what Isaiah does. That's what Scripture does. And it's because the Bible does that, that I have the faith to be able to say, if God is that right in what he's saying there, then what part of the Bible can we say is wrong? And this is where science, right, because it doesn't look into the Bible and project based on that, if they were to take these things and just mix their metaphors a little and just say, look, if this book, this collection of books, because that's what a Bible is, Bible means library, and we've got all of these books, but there's a commonality to them. There's a thread and a flow that runs through them that says that although they're written by different hands over thousands of years, there's one controlling mind behind it. That beggars belief. That is astounding. How great is our God? How fantastic and awesome and mind-blowing is the God that can come up with this book that we call the Bible, that gives us so much information that we can trust and rely upon. And the prophecy is there to give us that confidence. If he's right in that, how is he not right, number one, about how the world came into being? But much more importantly than that, how the world is going to end. Because when it comes right down to it, who cares how the world was created? We're here. It's a done deal. There's a level at which you say, that doesn't matter. It's much more important. Where are we going? Why are we here? What does the future and the end look like? And sadly for all these scientists, it just looks bleak and empty. That's the sad thing about this. You know, there's a couple of accompanying articles that I could have brought along as well. But they're basically saying, a few million years from now, this galaxy won't exist. This Earth won't exist. It will have petered out. It will have run its course. And whatever we believe about cosmology will be lost with it. That was actually a phrase that I saw coming out of it. Everything, including what we understand or might understand about cosmology itself, will be lost along with the rest of the cosmos. That's their future. How bleak is that? They live a blink of an eye, and then they return to the dust of the ground with no more thought and no more presence. Life is futile. That's what they're saying. It's all futility. Make what you can of the time that you've got, because there's nothing else for you. And I come back to a book that says, a child is going to be born, and that child will have government on his shoulders, not just for a lifespan, but for all eternity. And the detail that is built around that, even telling us that physically that same born child is going to grow to die, but not die, if you understand what I'm saying. Because death for Jesus Christ was his release back into his God form. And we have a high priest. We have a human in eternity. And in that human, this is what this book tells us, in that human, we share in his eternal being. We have a hope that goes beyond this life. And this same book tells us that this cosmos will still be here in 5 million years' time. Or if it isn't, 5 million years won't matter, because when we move from time into eternity, the time element it is just not there. But we will continue. The earth will continue. And the rest of creation will have a purpose, starting with this galaxy, then moving out. There's a big job to be done, folks. Physically, we can't even see the whole job. But science tells us, bless them, that it's all there. There's all of these rocks out there to be populated and shaped and adorned for the glory of God the Father and for his Son and for the Spirit that dwells in each and every one of us. That's Christmas. That's incarnation. And that is biblical cosmology. Thank you.